Welcome to Ear Biscuits. I'm Rhett.
And I'm Link. This week at the table of round.
Oh, wow, you would have thought that it would have been ingrained by now.
This week at the round table of dim lighting. That's it.
The table of round.
Not the table of round lighting. In a
well,
dim
it
room.
Is round. I mean,
yeah,
it,
the
we have a
is,
like
yeah,
a,
the light's round.
A globular light. It is round. It's all, but, and it's not as dim as it used to be.
Yeah, I.
Is it, you want to quit saying?
I saw that there was a post.
We can't say that it's.
Kiko, there was a post, and somebody was like taking pictures and like doing this different strata of screens of how Ear Biscuits has gotten increasingly less dim.
Well, it got really dim, and
it
for
was
a little
very
bit,
dim,
and that was because there was something was wrong.
Well, no, it started off dim because there was no video, and we had guests, and we had this idea that like. If you create like a dark space, people are gonna share their dark secrets. And I believe that it helped.
It's welcoming, yeah.
I mean, we were down in our basement and it was just us and somebody getting into it in the dark.
It wasn't a basement though.
No, it wasn't. It you felt like a basement.
The other studio.
At the other studio, you're right.
It was
the felt
first
like a
floor.
Basement because there were no, all the windows were blacked out.
Right.
You're right, it wasn't a basement. And then when we started doing video, which comes out a week later, YouTube channel, Ear Biscuits, if you're listening and you wanna start watching. And then we were like, man, it's a little too dim. We gotta make it brighter because this is video. You kinda wanna see the people.
But it was still dimmer than it needed to be because it was like, man, it's.
We've increasingly
made it
less
saying,
dim.
But I saw that post too and I thought that it had a temporary, really dark, it was a dark time.
We had a dark time.
And that was just because something had been dialed in wrong. But then we fixed that and then we've slowly gotten it a little bit brighter.
Did you add this, there's like a pull down projector screen just beyond this main camera here. Was that added just as a reflector or was that already there?
Mm-hmm. It was added after.
It was added?
Yeah, we decided that we wanted it a little bit brighter.
Okay.
Yeah, it reflects.
What'd you do, bring Ben in here to have ideas? You just came up with this.
It was kind of like a team effort with me and Ben, yeah.
Yeah, I know, it seemed like a Ben thing. So we got, it's a projector screen, but there's no projector anywhere. It's we're just using a projector screen as a bounce. That is gratuitous.
We could project something.
That is the, you know, that we are high rolling. We got a projector screen with no projector, just for the bounce. That's how high we're rolling.
No,
that's how large we're living.
Let's put a projector right in between us. Let's
right.
replace
so
the
while
Ear
we're
Biscuit
doing the,
sign with a large projector.
Yeah, so while we're doing the podcast, we can be watching a movie. I wanna watch The Mandalorian again. I know, by the time this comes out, like most all, I don't know how many episodes there are, but like, so I know it's a little late, but I just have to gush a little bit. I'm still trying to get you to watch it.
Oh, I'm gonna watch it, but what about what we're gonna talk about today?
Oh yeah.
Which is not The Mandalorian.
This week at the Round Table of Dim Lighting, we're talking about our book.
Yeah.
We're gonna go into specific story points based on your questions, comments, desires. The Lost Cause is a bleak creek, has a lot of details and a lot of, some controversy it appears.
And this is going to be full of spoilers. So might I suggest, and this will be after the break that we get into this. So if you haven't read the book yet, before we get into these questions, just stop this podcast and go pick it up. Listen to it on Audible.
You listen to this podcast and you haven't read our book, well, you can listen to the audio version of the book and it's kind of like a good replacement for Ear Biscuits or, you know, for a little bit. So go to Audible,
well,
go to Amazon. Get
12
the,
or 13
get the Audible,
Ear Biscuits together.
Get the Audible version of the book and listen to that thing.
And then come back and enjoy this discussion. Now, if you're the kind of person who's like, I'm not reading the book, I don't care how many times you guys say it, I'm not a reader.
We respect that,
yeah,
I guess.
That's cool, whatever. I'd still push back a little bit on that and say, just read it. Just, if you're gonna read one book, read this book. And then if you still are like, I'm not a reader and I'm not gonna make my first book I ever read your book.
Then just keep listening.
Then just listen.
Just listen to us talk about a book that you haven't read.
It's not gonna be that. I mean, we're gonna get into a lot of things, but you know, it's not gonna ruin it for you if you ever do go back on that and decide to read.
I mean, it's I'm gonna have a moment of gratitude here. I'm still so grateful that this novel has been created, that we made it, that we wrote it, that it's done, that it's bound, and that it's sitting on shelves. Oh, speaking of sitting on shelves, me, Christy, and Lando, we went to the mall, and we were going to the Galleria, but really, what we were doing was we were going to Din Tai Fung, because it was just us with Lando, and we were like, we got to eat at a special place, and maybe our favorite restaurant as a family is Din Tai Fung. They got these dumplings. Good gosh, you can look through a window, and they're like folding these dumplings at like a rapid speed, something that would be like one of those satisfying manufacturing videos that I would watch on Reddit. It's just like people working like robots. They're just amazingly fast and
they will be replaced with robots.
Oh my gosh, and the dumplings are so good.
Dumpling robots.
I mean, the wait was 2 hours, but when I finally got in there, what do you order from there? Because I ordered the crab and pork dumplings.
I don't know, I just order a little bit of everything.
Once you eat those, everything else is.
Crab and pork together?
Yeah, those are the best ones. Soup dumplings, you like bite the edge, and the soup comes out, and then you dip it in the vinegar and the hot saucy stuff.
I don't think I would enjoy eating those with you.
Well, and listen.
Do you make noises like that?
I put the first one in my mouth.
I can only imagine you have a system.
And it. You know, they're not the best things for you, especially when you eat as many as I eat. So I try not to go there, but like once a quarter. But when I go hard. The first one I put in my mouth, I was like, this thing is so good. I close my eyes, man. I'm sitting there in the restaurant and I've been transported to Shanghai. That's Shanghai for you. And I'm just like savoring it and not. Boy, that's one of my happy places. You know, when you're like going through a surgery, you're like having a cyst removed, or you're like.
I appreciate your passion about dumplings.
Like you need to go to a happy place. That's where I'm going.
Once
crab
again,
and pork in my mouth.
You're really easily distracted today. Like you've gotten off on two tangents.
Oh, the book.
Yeah, the book. That's what we're talking
about. So we're waiting. So we go over to Barnes & Noble and I'm like, oh, I bet you The Lost Cause of Bleak Creek is here. Chris is like, yeah, I saw it. I've been in here a few days ago. And it's on this shelf right there at the front, like at the table, like new fiction.
Yeah, the table that you want to be on.
I felt, you know, I looked at it, but I didn't want to like sit there and like pick it up and like stare at it like a lost child in the mall that
I
just
found. Did you
think
about signing it?
Christy was like, you should sign it. I was like, I don't want to do that. Cause then you have to have this weird interaction with Mr. Noble or Mr. Barnes and be like, excuse me, sir, why are you writing in the books? It's like, well, like, you know, I'm one of the authors of this book. It's like, depending on where it's printed online, you might not see me as the author. You might only see Rhett McLaughlin because apparently there's not enough space to put two authors on stuff.
Yeah, I didn't have anything to do with that.
But I am on the front of the book. And if you, when you put the discounted sticker, you also put that over my name. So it's a novel for number one New York Times bestselling authors, Rhett McLaughlin, and
20% off.
20% off.
Yeah.
I just get the short end of the stick, man.
Well, with, your name's shorter.
With the second book, my name needs to be first.
Okay.
Is that a deal? You just said okay.
TBD.
we need to figure that out. So I was a little self-conscious, and then we kind of walked away. I was like, I know what the book looks like. I'm not gonna buy it. And you know, there's escalators in there, and I just noticed when I went up the escalator that I was turning back and looking down and looking at my book. I just couldn't believe it. We have a novel in Barnes & Noble.
Well, I went to the-
Other places.
To the Vromans, I guess is how you pronounce that?
Yeah, in Pasadena.
And which is that-
That's my go-to.
I like that, it's independent bookstore. And they got a lot of cool stuff. It's right next to the Lamley, which incidentally.
Subtitled movies?
I saw Jojo Rabbit there.
Oh, man. Why didn't you invite me?
I just took Shepard, just me and Shepard.
What's it rated?
It's PG-13.
Okay, he's 13.
He's 11, but I was with him. I guided him through it. boy, speaking of tangents.
Is it good? I gotta see it.
I mean.
Taika Waititi was also in Mandalorian.
It's
he's a freaking droid.
It's so good. It's so good. But I'm not talking about that. I don't wanna get off on a tangent.
Isn't he great though?
And he's great in that too.
I'd like to meet him.
He's even great as Hitler. I mean, it's just like, when someone can make Hitler likable, and you know, I'm not.
Spoiler alert.
I'm not gonna give away anything because he doesn't really make Hitler likable. If you understand what Hitler represents in that movie. Okay. Anyway, so.
So I was longingly looking at the book as I was going up to the second and third floor, but I didn't want Chrissy to see me looking at it. I thought she was like, "You're looking down there at your book, aren't you?" It's like, well, yeah, it's my book. It's down. I mean, how often do you get to look in a bookstore and see your own book? It's thrilling, man.
But I was in Romans and I was like, well, of course I got to find the book. And I was actually thinking I might sign it because the last time I was in Romans, one of the employees came up to me and was like, Rhett, would you mind signing some copies of the Book of Mythicality? Because they had that out in the like internet humor section or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And with all the other YouTuber books. But I was more excited about this because I was like, oh, our book's gonna be in the fiction section and like the part of the bookstore that everybody goes, not the internet humor that like only if you're lost on your way to the bathroom do you find it.
Right. That'd be good for the toilet.
And so it's not quite as well organized and set up as a Barnes & Noble in that there's also like five entrances to this bookstore and you don't know what's the front. There's multiple cashiers. And
I love that because it makes it easy to steal their books. You know, they got to spread out their security.
Right, yeah.
I'm rolling out of there with books. Like, you know, Dune's a thick book. But when you got multiple exits, you just bide your time and you're taking that Dune down your pants.
That guy's got a lot of junk in his trunk shaped like a book.
I have not, and I do not advocate stealing books, but you can put it down your pants, just pull it back out and purchase it.
So I go to the fiction section and they have new and noteworthy. That's what they call it, I think. And there it was.
Well, being as ours was new, does that mean it wasn't noteworthy?
Well, no, it was on. It's new and noteworthy.
It was both, not either or.
And, but then they had the bestsellers section, which is like a nice shelf with like a really nice light on it.
Yeah.
We weren't on that, which I was like.
But that was before we were technically a bestseller.
No, this was yesterday.
Oh, they didn't get the memo?
So I almost, well, a couple of things. I almost offered to sign one or two.
But then
there were only two left.
Only two, you decided not to.
And then I was almost like, well, how come we can't put it on the bestseller? It is a bestseller, but you know.
So you thought about going into negotiations. You're like, excuse me, I'd be more than happy to sign my novel if you'd be more than happy to put it under the lights.
Yeah. So we can move these last two.
You could just moved them over.
But that's a cool thing. A lot of people have been reporting that they've been going to various bookstores and they're out. They've sold out of a number of these. So.
There's
more on the way. There's a second printing already. Yeah,
and the new printing is going to say New York Times bestseller, something like that, right?
Oh, I didn't.
That will be printed on it. It's not going to be a sticker, but it will be over my name.
You were taking Link's name.
Taking my name off of the book,
and it's going to say
New York Times bestseller.
It's going to say a novel from number one New York Times bestselling authors Rhett McLaughlin, and this is also a New York Times bestselling book. That's what it's gonna say. Yeah, sorry, Link. But
no,
you know what?
They sent us the mock-up, but I didn't open it.
You're in the picture in the back, and you're standing in front of me. So that I think that makes up for it.
I love the fact that you knew that before you looked at it. Like, you know that I'm standing in front of you in that picture.
But no, I knew that when we chose this picture.
Because you didn't. You're so much bigger than me.
No, I think you always stand a little bit in front of me because I'm taller. But this is like, your elbow is all the way across my belly button. That's in my opinion, that's just a little too far in front.
My face is
way bigger
than your face.
It's because like not only, I think that it's the wide angle lens that they're using to take this picture with. So typically we'd be the same size, but my head looks really, really small and really far away. So it all evens out is what I'm getting at.
I don't know if that evens out.
You wanna answer? Oh, and another thing I thought is it's a really cool cover, but people are putting like really bright colors on covers now, kind of playing like the YouTube thumbnail game with book covers.
Do we lose?
And I was like, I don't know how much I would just, it's a really cool cover, but I don't know how eye-catching it is when you just put it next to like 20 other books.
Yeah, it doesn't have the letters should have been neon pink.
Yeah, so maybe the next, printing, well, we should call them right now and go all neon. We'll say, no explanation, it's all neon this time.
Yeah.
Gotta get those clicks. Okay, we're gonna answer some questions about the book. This is a good time for you to pause the podcast and go buy the book and read it.
Bleakcreek.com. So we have questions from loyal listeners and avid readers, a lot of discussions happening on the Mythical Society Discord as well. So I think that's gonna, we've read all of that, so I think that's going to color some of our answers. And I think that, I know we should wait for the Ruby questions until the end. So let's save those, but start anywhere you want to start.
Let's start with a question from Mythical Cop Wife.
Okay.
We've met her a number of times. That's why we're in her profile picture. very engaged member of the Mythical Community Society, etc. I would love to know more on Whitewood's backstory, on transforming from a seemingly normal person to the headmaster slash cult leader he became. What made him decide to go the route of forming a reform school? Was there no other way to get his ruby back? Now this is a, I think that this question represents or is related to a conversation that I have seen quite a lot of people having, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like the fact that our antagonist is revealed to have some humanity and almost might elicit some of your sympathy is something that people have kind of struggled with. They struggle with sort of wrapping their minds around, what am I supposed to think about this guy?
Mm-hmm.
Are you guys trying to justify his actions by saying, by giving, you know, explaining that the motivation is him doing whatever he can for his daughter? And some people are like, obviously, I don't care what your motivation was, your actions have hurt so many more people that I think our intention in doing that was, unlike, what was the bad dude in Captain Planet?
I never watched Captain Planet.
It was the guy who polluted and it seemed like the reason that the guy who polluted, who was the evil dude in Captain Planet, it just seems like he just got a kick out of just polluting the earth.
Oh, look, I'm getting a message.
Your hair is messed up.
Look at that, you talking about that? It's bothering you, thank you. Jenna's bothered because my hair was messed up after the hoodie.
Yeah, I was gonna let it ride.
You weren't gonna say anything?
Actually, I couldn't tell from my angle. But he polluted, and as a kid watching that, I was just like, this guy's just evil for the sake of being evil. Like, I didn't even make any connection to, and I don't know if the show did make a connection to, this guy's committed to industry, and therefore his pollution is just a byproduct. It seems like he just was a bad dude who wanted to pollute the planet. But I think in reality, everyone who does something that is wrong, for the most part, has their own internal morality that is telling them that what they're doing is justified, right? Most people make the decisions and they rationalize them. And we just kind of wanted something that you take this person and you've got all this hate built up for them. And then you see that, oh, actually he has reasons, that doesn't excuse his actions, but the world's a messy place.
Yeah, well,
and people are complicated.
It's not justification, you know, but it's explanation. I mean, it's like, didn't you want to know? It's like, why is this guy doing this? Why, you know, he's constructed. I mean, and I guess that's the question. Like, why make a school? Why have a reform school? And
well, that's because that's what he knows. He was a principal in his former life. So he has run a school before.
And there was an opportunity because with the way that Bleak Creek worked, that there was a need for someone to step in and say, I can solve one of your biggest problems, which is, you know, I can address your one of your biggest fears, which is what's gonna happen to our children? Are they gonna stay, you know, are they gonna stay on the straight and narrow, or are they gonna go wayward? You know, as a parent, there're just times when you're struck with, oh my gosh, how are my children gonna turn out? And am I doing enough? You know, am I doing enough to help them become contributing members of society, like people who follow their heart, that are kind? You know, you want, but I mean, if you oversimplify that, or if at times as a parent, you just get to like, I just want them to act right. Like, if I could just do that, then maybe everything else will fall into place. Because if they start acting wrong, then that's a red flag that like something's really going wrong deeper, you know, that I'm really screwing up as a parent. And so I think he was smart enough to see that like, that fear goes very deep in a parent. So if I can tap into that and present the solution for a kid that they're just like throwing their hands up, I don't know what to do with this kid. You know, she's pulling the pants off of mannequins.
Yeah.
She's embarrassing me. She's, you know, they're interrupting prayers at the pig picking. Then that's, it's a nice, simple solution. And hey, the kids don't even have to live with me anymore.
Well, I think there's three contributing factors, right? The first thing was, the keeper specifically asked for kids who have kind of gone their own way, right? Kids who weren't falling in line. So you got to find those kids, right?
Right. That's his problem.
And so, right? So, okay. And then the second thing is that he's got experience with school administration. And then the third thing is kind of what you're getting at, which is early 90s, North Carolina, really America in general. We're still in the midst of moral panic that really kind of hit its peak in the 80s when mm-hmm. parents started really worrying about Satanism. I mean, we remember very, very clearly, like, there was a whole lot of moral panic around people actually worshiping Satan. Like we actually were told that, no, yeah. You guys, people are worshiping Satan. Never mind the fact that the whole Church of Satan was started as almost a mockery of the idea of religion in general. I remember thinking as a kid, I was like, so you're telling me that there are people who worship Satan, which means that they believe in the framework that there's a God and there's a Satan and they're choosing the bad guy. Yeah. Like, this is illogical on so many different levels.
And I was,
because you're buying into the worldview that includes Satan and then choosing him. I'm not saying that no one does that,
but it's not
a societal problem.
We knew
and it
enough,
never was.
We knew enough bad kids to be like, oh, that's a bad kid. I bet he would like to worship Satan.
Well, and then,
he's not saying that he does, but.
And then we were told that if you played all this rock music backwards, backmasking, like we would literally go.
Backmasking,
yeah. We would literally go to these presentations where these guys would get up and they would play Led Zeppelin and AC/DC and any other bands backwards and show all the satanic messages.
Whose power is Satan? That's what Robert Plant sang in reverse on a song.
Right.
Yeah, I remember that being a film from the 70s. It seemed like a 70s-ish film that was then screened again in the early 90s
for us
at Campbell University.
Bro, it's a little bit behind.
Well, it was, you know, it was they were still trying to eradicate the, Led Zeppelin was still popular.
But I think this is, what I'm pointing at is in line with what you were saying before, which is what an effective way to manipulate people and manipulate their behavior is to understand what their greatest fears are.
Right.
And then you can basically just begin selling them any kind of bullshit you want to.
If it works within the framework of what they already believe.
Exactly, so I'm saying is if you tell people that rock music is actually a subversive way to worship Satan, and that's consistent with the fears that they already have about it, then you can get them to believe things like people are intentionally putting satanic messages into their song because they legitimately worship Satan. If anyone actually ever did that, it was because they were playing into it in a tongue-in-cheek way. But anyway, so Whitewood is in a community where this is the way people think, and he's like, this is what my experience is, and these are the kids that I need in order to accomplish my mission. So you do that mathematical equation and you kind of come up with a really strict reform school that the kids have to live at. So you got to have control.
Right.
And then of course you've eventually got to get some other adults to help you out, and you've got to manipulate them as well.
And the way you do that is twofold. One, you play a mean organ at the church. I mean—
Trustworthy.
It's hard to argue with that. He's there every Sunday playing that organ. You know, that means a lot. He might have made a run at being a pastor, but like that takes a lot more time.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is you master that pit barbecue and you win them over.
Yeah.
You win them over. People can overlook a world of hurt. Literally, they overlooked like deaths. And which is something that we wrestled with, because it's like, man, once you have kids dying, is this town really going to just let this school just continue?
Well, but that happens all the time. I mean, it is, in my mind, it's not that big of a leap. People let injustice fester,
mm-hmm.
Especially when the person who's in charge of it seems legitimate, right? And there seems to be a legitimate explanation. I'm just like, oh, okay, three kids over a decade have died in accidents at this place. It's just like, and this is largely based on, so the reform school in the book, we had the whole thing sketched out, but then we actually, once we had outlined the entire book, we found out about this reform school.
Yeah, Lance found this article.
And somewhere in the Northeast that even up until within the last decade had operated, and they had found that they were doing all kinds of crazy disciplinary things on the kids, including rolling them up in a carpet.
Yep. Because we had written, let's see, I'm trying to figure out if we knew or if we changed it, but there was a box.
Yeah, well, we had not decided what the specific disciplinary thing was, but we knew we wanted it to be something where kids were isolated, and we wanted it to seem kind of like the carpet thing. So yeah, the first draft was the box, and it was a wooden box that was about 2.5 feet on each side, and you basically sort of ball a kid up and you'd put them in this dark box that had some breathing holes. And then the guy would come in and kind of kick it around, and you would end up upside down, and you couldn't get turned. It was too small to turn around inside.
But I just thought that there's just nothing. It just wasn't as memorable or as visceral as the roll. So the carpet roll is a real thing they did to kids. And these kids, once they reached adulthood, if I remember correctly, a lot of them were troubled. They had residual effects, and there was a lot of suicide.
Yeah,
a lot of them were dying, and then there was an investigation, like through Facebook, of like whatever happened to my classmates, and then like turns out a lot of them had committed suicide.
Yeah, I don't remember that
as a long term result.
I don't remember that detail, but there was a lot of bad stuff going on at the time, and people didn't raise an eyebrow, but it didn't cause any action.
Yeah, so it's sad that these things do happen. A related question: Shell, the Velvet Hook, who's changed the moniker to include Scooter Leg.
Yeah.
That's an homage.
Appreciate that.
You mentioned the seven-pointed star being significant. In Christianity, the seven-pointed star represents the seven gifts of the Spirit: wisdom, understanding, counsel, might, knowledge, fear, and delight. Those aren't the gifts of the Spirit that I know.
Yeah, that must be.
This is a different list.
Must be NIV.
I don't know.
It must be the message.
Yeah, it must be.
So that's some biblical translation humor for you.
So I wondered if this was a metaphor for the seven lost causes in some way. Absolutely, the seven-pointed star is a metaphor for the lost causes that that the cult needs to get into the spring.
Well, and let me pair this with this next question too from Fanto Moose, who asks, can you elaborate on the Latin used by the cult? First one seems to be vita est aqua, life is water, but couldn't completely figure out the second one, electus intrat aquam sanctum, selected in holy water. Yeah, so all the stuff that is true about the cult, like the robes, the seven-pointed star, the Latin chants that are happening, just to kind of get your mind in the right place, all of this
is false.
Was fabricated by Whitewood as a manipulative scheme to give the appearances and trappings of a cult or some sort of religious organization that these people would buy into. So it isn't like
The keeper didn't transfer this knowledge and this symbology to Whitewood. We know what the keeper wants. He wants seven lost causes. He wants kids of a certain age with a certain oomph to them, because there's his fuel is associated with that.
Right.
But everything else is Whitewood's problem.
Right, and the seven-pointed star, yes, it was chosen because the keeper told him, you gotta get seven kids. And while the seven-pointed star does have significance in Christianity, it also, like most symbols, it has significance in other places, including pagan religion. And we just took it and turned it upside down so that the predominant arrow—
Well, let's say Whitewood turned it upside down.
Was pointing down towards the earth, towards water. Also, the triangle in general in paganism is a symbol of water because it's pointing down. It's also a symbol of feminism because of the triangle.
What's that got to do with this?
I'm just letting you know. It wasn't a joke, I'm just letting you know. Now, the Latin specifically, so again, my thought process behind this was, when we were writing the section about the cult, I was like, okay, well, what could they chant? And I was like, all right, well, what if there was something that was like life is water or water is life? And then once they get down there and they're selecting the specific person to go into put their hand into the water, it'll be the selected one or the chosen one enters the water. And I can't remember whether or not the chosen one refers to the person chosen in sort of the weird duck, duck, goose game, or if it's that Whitewood himself. But anyway, it was very simply putting the meaning into Google Translate and going from English to Latin until we got something that, oh, that kind of seems like it could be a cool chant. And so, and also I was thinking at the time, we're probably gonna get a couple of things wrong, like maybe the tense is wrong, maybe this isn't a perfect translation, but let's not pay too much attention to it because we're trying to make it seem like this dude who has no experience in any of this stuff is like going to the library and kind of coming up with this language that wouldn't be perfect. This system would not be this perfectly cohesive system that feels like it has some sort of supernatural force, but it's more like somebody creating something to fool people. And it's gonna have some inconsistencies in it. So you're like, he chose this and this is what you chant. So everything has significance, but it doesn't have like metaphysical significance. It's just—
He made it up to make sense and to manipulate.
Systemic.
You know, kinda like, you think I was gonna throw another religion or cult under the bus, didn't you? So yeah, the Latin and the symbology, the star, the freaking star is on the side of the book. Look at that, this Whitewood tainted the spine of our novel.
They did.
Because there's the star, that means nothing. That's a deception, man. We got it right there on the side of on the spine of the book, because it looks cool.
But it means something now.
It means the lost, it means, yeah, it means.
Or else I what? Shouldn't have got it tattooed on my left butt cheek.
Oh. So yeah, he made all that stuff up, y'all. He made it all up. So then we go back to the fact, it's like, why would a guy go through all this trouble? And so I think you do feel for him, but it doesn't justify his actions. I mean, would you want to do anything to save your daughter, to remove your daughter's pain and to give her a full life? Well, hopefully not anything. Hopefully not this. you know? But I mean, it's not just the one decision. He's continually communing with his daughter who's frozen in time, you know? And every time he goes down there, his heart is wrenched one more time. So it's like, at a certain point, he's kind of, again, I'm not trying to justify this, but you psychologically, you can go crazy trying to care for somebody if you've reached a total dead end, and especially if it's like, this is the answer. If you just do this, you know, you can find yourself becoming convinced of, or justifying your actions.
Yeah, I mean, so we wanted it to be a little bit messy and complicated, but ultimately, you're still, I mean, if you're normal, you're still gonna conclude that none of the stuff that he's doing is actually justified. It's just he has his own reasons, which may draw a little bit of sympathy from you, but not to the point that you think any of it's justified.
Just think, I mean, you got this poor girl who doesn't wanna get out of her dress getting in there. "Oh my Lord," Wayne said, "it was working. The water all around them began to bubble. Wayne began to laugh, unconcerned about disturbing anyone who might be within earshot. Ruby laughed too. "This is really fun." She pushed off the bottom, beginning to swim. Wayne was careful not to let go of her hand. That didn't matter though. As soon as she dropped her face below the surface, Ruby was violently sucked down into the water. Her hand slipped from her father's. "Ruby," he yelled, "baby." Then he got spit out.
Moving along, I mean, this is a question related to the spring. Joel McRae asks, "Are the seven souls taken by the keeper dead? What happened to them? Do they go to an afterlife or just not exist?" So no, the seven souls that are in there are in the same situation that Rex, I mean, that Leaf and Alicia were,
mm-hmm.
In this book. So in this state of stasis, which your body is not aging, there's some things happening in your mind, of course. The longer that you're there, it seems like the less you can kind of remember and hold on to that the life that you had before. And interestingly, I don't want to get into too much of this because I don't like taking so much of the mystery, any of the mystery out. But I will say that the nature of the spring and the keeper of the spring, and even the nature of this, the void and the people sort of being suspended in time and kind of trapped in this place, every element of that is at least somewhat influenced by sort of like Celtic mythology. Right, and that's why in the book they break out the giant book that talks about, I can't remember the name of the book, but that's when they get some information about the nature of the spring and the blood and all this stuff, and the blood being the key. That's because now that particular, some of the particular choices that we made are just things that we came up with, but the general idea of like there being this sort of being in charge of a spring that represents almost a portal to a slightly different plane of existence. These are concepts that come up time and time again in Celtic mythology, which in a second, when we get to the end, we'll talk about what does this mean about a potential second book and where else could this go. But I will say that all of that is, it's not completely fabricated. We didn't just invent it out of thin air. We kind of looked and did some research on the way people thought about that in sort of ancient Celtic times, and used that to influence us. So no, long answer short, those people are not dead. They're still in the void.
You mentioned when we were talking about Whitewood, you said like he would come up with the symbology and the Latin and stuff, like if he like went to the library and was doing research, which reminds me of this question. Jade_IEMRG, is the man who told Janine in the library basement about the deaths at Whitewood School going to be talked about at all? He disappeared, and I have a feeling his character has a story to be told. Yeah, we're working on a spinoff novel series about library dude, creepy library dude.
Yep.
Well, first of all, You ever go to the library? There's always somebody who like, you can tell they spend a lot of time at the library.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe Whitewood went there. Janine definitely went there for answers. And this guy apparently knew what she was looking for and had a little information, but then either he was ghost or he just ghosted. I mean, he wanted to help, but do you have a straightforward answer? Because I have a roundabout answer. Who is this guy?
Well, go ahead.
I just think that in this town, you can't expect everyone to believe exactly the same thing for there not to be anybody who's more suspicious. So it's to me, it rang true that there's at least somebody that you encounter in this story that's like, it's just not taking this hook, line, and sinker.
Somebody who's a little bit of a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, conspiracy theorists are right.
And then, but then not accepted. Kind of like, we say conspiracy theorists with derision. And I'm sure in the town, you know, any naysayer would be, you know, who knows what they'd be saying on, scratching on the side of his car. You know, so it's like, hey, I'm gonna help you out a little bit, but I don't want to be associated with this. It's like the simple explanation.
Well,
who is he and how much does he really know?
And I would say an even simpler explanation that doesn't even, it's very much, all right, she needs to do some kind of research and she needs to, again, this is one of those things that in storytelling, it's like, okay, well, Janine needs to learn something that the audience needs to also know in order to move this story forward. Where would you get this type of information? Well, you would get it at a library. What kind of town is Bleak Creek? And also, what kind of story are we trying to tell? Okay, I think that the library scene is actually pretty indicative of exactly the way we wanted to write this book. So the first thing that happens is, okay, something ironically funny.
Yeah.
There's a loud librarian. It's a simple joke that we got a good bit of mileage out of, right?
Right.
And then, oh, but this is also a scary, scary thing. So she's gonna go down into this basement. It's gonna get a little bit weird when she says that she's asking about the Whitewood School. And what better way to introduce a little bit of, I mean, she obviously passes this guy who's kind of following her with his eyes as she goes down and walks through the main part of the library to then go to the basement. And then what if all of a sudden he's just right behind her? Not necessarily because there is significance to this guy that will be explored later, but mostly because it's just really creepy.
Well, and because
it's a more inventive way to get this information.
You know that she's being watched. You know that she's, you know, she's being, there's increasing attention on Janine's efforts. And so like, how far is this gonna go? You know, is she gonna be harmed? And so,
right. Yeah.
Hopefully you're thinking that as you're reading this, that like, I mean, she's lying about the recipes and that's kind of, it's not going too great. You know, it's like, I really enjoy her lies. And, but I was, you know, I'm hoping that the reader's like, okay, I just don't know if that lie is good enough. I think she might be putting a target on her back.
Yeah.
Or like I said, on her car, at least.
Yeah, well, and you know.
So then what's this guy gonna do?
Well, and the funny thing is, you know, I mean, it's obvious by the way we ended the book, which somebody pointed out in a question, that we want the story to continue. Yeah, the book ends with, Ruby's out. And this is not quite reconciled. I mean, no justice has been done to what these adults have been doing and what's going on in the spring. And there's still people that we love and care about who are stuck there. Is Alicia gonna get back to normal? There's a lot of open questions and that was very, very intentional. And I think that one of the interesting things that we're finding is when you ask this question about this man. Well, I just told you, no, there was no greater significance to this guy. He represents an opportunity to make the scene scary, and he's also indicative of just the nature of the town, and like Link said, that there's gonna be people who are skeptical about this school. But the cool thing about potentially writing a second book is if we wanted there to be significance to that guy and we wanted to make it almost retroactive, as long as you don't do anything that is contradictory to the way that you set it up in the first book, you have the right to do that.
Well, it's not that we didn't, I do think it was important with that guy that like, it does also send the message that there are potential allies in this town. Everybody's not against these kids. It's not just and Janine, you know? So there's a little bit, you're not wrong.
I'm just saying that's not the process that
but there's
that
potential
went, that went into it. It's not the process that went into it, but we talked about this. We haven't talked about it on the show,
but there's an openness to it. That's the point I'm making.
You know what? And this leads to another question.
Talking about
the question about the
Dennis.
Dennis, yes. So read that question.
Julia, which is Jula 483 asked, was Dennis calling Janine, who was still in Bleak Creek, just a weird coincidence, or was there something supernatural happening there? Him calling her all of a sudden when she was in doubt and not sure if she should stay or leave was almost too perfect.
And a related question from Griffiest, that, and she actually replied, he or she actually replied to this question, that, or I was even thinking at the time that he might have been paid off or encouraged by someone or one of the cult members to get her to leave town.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I had a really awesome answer to this, but the answer is no. It was just the best way to tell the story.
It was dramatic timing.
If it was all a little too perfect, well, yeah, it might have been a little too perfect, but sometimes you need your characters to do something that will do the perfect thing for your story.
Hey, things happen serendipitously in real life too.
Yeah, they do all the time. You want to
avoid the cumulative effect of a lot of that happening and driving the story forward.
We didn't make it. There's not a whole lot of super convenient things that happen, but there are some convenient things that happen, so you don't have to sit through an unnecessary chapter to move the story forward. And also, it's our first novel. I'm sure.
Don't apologize.
Well, but I'll also say that
don't make excuses.
I read like well-established writers all the time, and I see things that I'm like, whoa, that's right there is so convenient that it's just, and I tend to not be very judgmental about that kind of thing, but I find some things get too convenient sometimes. I don't think this is necessarily one of them, but I think it relates to the question that we were answering before, which is kind of the way that intentions and symbolism, in fact, I was in a classroom last week. Locke was doing this tour of this place, and there was in the writing classroom, the English classroom, there was I'm going to get this wrong, but the quote was, I don't know whether the author intended what my teacher says they intended or if she's just making it up. But it was a very funny way to kind of word that. And I think that,
we're just glad to be a part of the discussion.
I don't know I think it may have been Hank Green talking about his book, but somebody had seen something in his book and he was like, I'd like to take credit for that, but no, I'm glad that you see that way. But right. I think it goes back to the process of like, once you put yourself in a certain frame of mind and you're in a certain setting and you're telling a certain story, there are going to be things that, like even the observation that you made about the nature of the friendship and the way that they held hands around the tree, the observation that you made in the documentary, which wasn't, the reason we put it in the book is because, well, that was what we remembered. We remembered three people holding hands around a tree and not being able to reach. And then you made the connection that this is like, well, if two people are holding hands, the other two people can't be holding hands. And so it sort of represents the inherent tension in a three-way relationship, you know? It's not that that's not true, it's just that that wasn't intended. People can find the meaning in that, and I think that's totally fine to find the meaning in something, but that doesn't mean that all of that was there. It's just when you're in a certain frame of mind when you're writing, and then the person's in a certain frame of mind when they're reading. There's going to be connections made, and for me, that's just a beautiful part of the reading process, is that finding those things and attaching meaning, even in places that it could have been subconsciously inserted by a writer. It doesn't necessarily have to be intentional.
I think that was the case there, because we were very much talking about the relational dynamics and like Leaf trying to confess his crush and that being thwarted. You know, it's like, and then that's the very next thing that we talk about. You know, it's an easy connection. Let's move to the—
Well, but to keeping in the same theme, this question from Nicole Tennant, Sunday Rain 26, is there any significance to the blue frog?
So Ruby's blue frog left on the bed.
And yes, there is very specific significance to it. I don't know exactly where it could go, but the reason that it's a blue frog is, of course, the blue sort of represents the theme of water that we're dealing with, and that's why the robes are blue and the cult. But the frog is, of course, amphibious, which represents the ability to go between two different worlds, two different modes of existence, a frog being able to go into water and then on land.
And who does that?
And also, the frog itself does have, once you start kind of searching like spiritual or symbology of frog or something like that, you'll be taken to like 12 different websites and they all kind of have a different interpretation. But I did find one website that talked about there's a sort of a spiritual analog to the amphibious nature of a frog, being that it represents the ability to kind of go between two planes of existence, both, you know, the physical world and the spiritual world. And I think that the void does represent some sort of metaphysical, spiritual plane of existence that isn't necessarily the other world or underworld, but it's something different. And so that is the significance of the frog. Where we're gonna go with that, we don't know exactly, but yes, there's a reason that it was a frog and that wasn't accidental.
And if you remove the R in frog, you get what? Fog. And fog is something that lingers over what?
A bog.
Water. Okay, Austin Reed, Reaper Crew 96. Can we talk about the very last scene when Alicia's going down the street and sees Ruby in the epilogue? Is that a hint at a second book? When Ruby got out of the spring, is she still a little kid or has she grown up the 10 years? Hashtag ear biscuits. She has not grown up the 10 years. She's the same age she was when she went in.
She's 7 years old.
She's 7 years old. So yeah, let's talk about that scene. Is it a hint at a second book? Wouldn't I like to know? I hope so.
Yeah, it was our
second book that doesn't exist yet.
It was our big hint at the fact that we want to write a second book. It's not necessarily up to us whether or not there will be a second book, but it represented our intention that there will be.
But it would be cool to have like Ruby in a second book.
Oh yeah.
Or maybe we just forget about her. It's like, you know what? That's just a dangling participle. Let's move on to something else. Let's forget about Ruby. She's not gonna be in the second book. Was there another question? I think, I thought there was another Ruby question, but you know.
Yeah, there is. From Lex, why was Ruby the most attached to the keeper when she wasn't the first kid to drown in the spring? Because you know, there's Timothy who is in there, who's the kid who, I can't remember how many years ago it would have been, but basically when the spring shut down was when he drowned, according to the people, according to his parents, according to the people in the town, the Bleak family that was running the resort. He drowned, but we know that, no, he didn't drown, he's been in there. So, okay, so why is it that the keeper is sort of speaking through and obviously more attached to Ruby? Again,
his question was, why is it Ruby so attached to the keeper? I guess it's the same question.
Most attached to the keeper. Well, again, I think the answer is the most straightforward, and that is the keeper wants more children, right? The keeper's made that very clear. apparently he didn't have any, Timothy being down there wasn't doing anything for him, but Ruby, because of the way that it ended up working out where both Ruby and Whitewood went down at the same time, now the keeper is an opportunist, right? So the keeper knows that now I've got the carrot, Ruby, in the spring, that I, and now I can manipulate Whitewood and get him to do my bidding. And so he's naturally going to be more attached to Ruby because she is the way that he can accomplish his purposes. Unlike Timothy, which apparently hasn't worked out so well.
Right. So, let's shift to more of a summary of like, okay, so where does this leave us? I mean, rest assured we've given a lot of thought to where we're leaving the reader, and we've given a lot of thought to where we want to take you in a follow up, which you know, we're not saying that's definitely happening because we don't know that that's definitely happening at this point, but we certainly hope that we'll have the opportunity to write a second book. So honestly, the more buzz that continues to be generated and around this book, the greater the chances that we get the opportunity to write this second book, which we've already been working on. So
yeah, we know where we want to go in the second book. Again, it's just a question of will we have the privilege to do so. Okay, so in summary, kind of where we leave off in book one. And this is, if you for some reason have decided to listen to this podcast up until this point.
And now you're thinking you want to read it?
You or really listen to it, need to pause the podcast.
This is not, yeah.
Because I'm going to like summarize where it ends. So just don't listen to this, please.
Don't listen to this.
There are a number of people who are inside the void. Ben, because he was taken by the wave at the end. Josephina, the girl who befriended Alicia inside Whitewood.
Josephina really liked that frog. I will say that. You know, when I was like, Josephina, and this is me, but like just putting myself in the mind of the reader. Why you keep touching that frog and like messing up Ruby's room so much? That made me uncomfortable.
Good.
The fact that they were getting too comfortable in that room, and then Whitewood snatched them up.
The two kids who were thrown in during the commotion at the end of the book. So there was the crazy moments where they were getting Leaf and Alicia out, but there were other kids being thrown in and rejected. Well, Patrick Small and April Lee are two kids that have, they're mentioned as missing at the end of the book by the sheriff.
They are lost.
They are in the void.
Because they are lost causes.
There are three former Whitewood students who've been there for years since their supposed deaths. That's Richard Stanley in 1982. A 16-year-old girl, unnamed.
She's
the one that—
There's the fire and then there's the—
Richard Stanley was the one in the oven.
Yeah, the
oven. And the 16-year-old girl was the one that was smoking next to the gas leak, or supposedly.
That was stupid.
And then there's the boy that was struck by lightning in 1989, who's also unnamed.
That really happened.
And then there's Timothy Bleak, who's the first kid to ever be taken into the spring, at least, you know, in the span of our story. Maybe things happened before, I don't know. He's been there since 1961, when he drowned, in quotes. And that shut down the original Bleak Creek Resort. Now you might do the math on that and realize that that's more than seven kids. That's eight kids. And again, or is that, no, that's, no. No. So if you count
nine.
Ruby, that's nine. If you count Ruby, that's nine.
So again, the seven.
The seven kids was just a number, the seven additional kids given to Whitewood for, again, I don't try to put too much logic behind why the keeper needs a certain number.
But if he's saying seven, then
his real number
is nine. His real number was nine.
Yeah, and you could get into some numerology there if you want, and the significance of seven and the significance of nine, if you want to read about that a little bit. I'm not going to say that isn't at least...
Go to the library.
It works out nicely.
See who comes up to you.
Oh,
the library guy. Don't forget him.
Now, the sheriff, Sheriff Lawson and the rest of the cult, Mary Hathaway, Shackelford, etc.
Now Mary Hathaway's dead. You wish. She ain't dead.
I'm about to say.
She's so likable.
They have explained everything to the town by saying that Whitewood was acting nefariously, kidnapping, murdering kids. They basically say that the original kids from the 80s are presumed dead, but the most recent four, which would be Ben, Josephina, Patrick, and April, are just presumed missing.
With Whitewood on the lam.
Maybe being held someplace with Whitewood. Again, I'm just giving you, this is all the stuff that the sheriff says at the end, just so your mind will be in the right place. And the cult itself still believes that the seven lost causes are being purified by the one below, and that they will return as the seven shepherds.
Poor Travis.
They just don't know how long it's gonna take.
Or maybe, I mean, you're mad at Travis because he, you know, he double crossed him, but it's just, you know, it's just to use the parlance of the situation, it's the testimony to Whitewood's ability to manipulate that Travis, a guy who's like so genuine, such a good-hearted guy, in endeavor to deceive and, you know, to keep that from the kids as much as he did.
Yeah.
Which then, you know, is there a rereading of the scene at the river? You know, that like, what does that tell you about Travis? If you take another look at that scene, you know, with the button. It's not for us to answer. I'm just saying it's just okay. Food for thought for the rereader. Travis is one of my favorite characters, by the way.
Rex,
California Raisins.
Rex, Leaf, Alicia, and Hornhat, and all the other kids who were in the school, are effectively compelled to remain quiet for the fear that the sheriff or the cult will kill their parents, do other crazy stuff. And then anybody who decides that they're gonna say something could also be dismissed pretty easily because you got a bunch of traumatized kids that have been in this weird place that, of course, they're gonna say things about it. And then finally, Janine and Donna, you know, they've shown their film, which has been interpreted by that initial audience as
a precursor to Blair Witch. Well, not in a very loose sense.
Yeah, basically a mockumentary, a fictional documentary, not a true expose. Somebody did ask a question of why did you make that decision to do that, and it's because that we don't want the loop to, if all of a sudden it was like, and she makes a film and everybody sees that, they're all crazy murderous cult members, well then the case is closed on that. We don't want the case to be closed.
Yeah, I mean the cult successfully, you know, destroyed the most damning information. And so you're left kind of like, I'm not really, I think it's the most, it's a pretty reasonable response, I think. It's like,
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, this is a marketing ploy, you know?
Yeah.
All right, where does that leave us? Well, hashtag Ear Biscuits, first of all, if you want to continue this discussion, and if you want to join the Mythical Society, make sure you talk about it on Discord.
Yeah, because there's some really—
chapter by chapter—
Really great discussions happening.
Discord conversations happening.
And listen, we, like Link said, yes, we want to continue telling this story. The only way that's going to happen is if the book continues to be a success, and that requires the book to continue to break outside of this, the community of Mythical Beasts. Of course, you guys have been super supportive and many of you have bought it, but we need to demonstrate continued interest in the fact that this thing is bigger than just the Mythical Beasts. So that means buying the book for somebody, encouraging them to read it. Maybe they don't, maybe this isn't, maybe you've tried to introduce them to the world of mythicality before, but you sent them a video where we were eating animal testicles and that's not their thing. We do other things, as we've hopefully demonstrated with this book, that I think are maybe even more accessible. So,
and did you say
share the book.
Did you say leave an Amazon review?
I didn't say that.
Yes.
But you should do that as well.
That's a big help. If you read the book.
Or Goodreads as well.
And so on Goodreads or Amazon, please leave a review of The Lost Causes of Bleak Creek. It makes a difference and we truly appreciate it. I'm gonna give a quick rec. I was telling you about this right beforehand. So shifting gears a little bit. I've never listened to Jim James, lead singer of My Morning Jacket. But I started reading, I stumbled upon a song on his new album, solo album called The Order of Nature. The song that I listened to first is called Set It to Song, but this is the Louisville Orchestra and Teddy Abrams teamed up with Jim James to like make this song cycle. It's unbelievable how this thing works, but like, I'll just read a summary of this. He has so many albums and they're all so distinct, and I've just been introduced to the world of Jim James, so I've just scratched the surface. You can come along with me. A fully orchestrated song cycle titled The Order of Nature, in which James pondered the roles of hatred and compassion in the natural world, is his latest album, recorded live with the Louisville Orchestra. That's pretty amazing. He's on tour. I gotta try to see that. Well, he's gonna be in Denver on May 15th. Let's go to Denver. Jim James. All right, hashtag Ear Biscuits. Let's keep the conversation going. Thanks for hanging out with us and for enjoying the spoilers.
And we'll be here for another, how many episodes do we have left? Two additional episodes in 2019, and then we're going to take another 2-week break.
Be back on January 6th.
Because your boys got to have a break. And yeah, we'll be back bigger and better than ever. Actually, it'll be exactly the same.
Or will it? I don't think it will be, actually.